This is the SF Signal Podcast, episode number 7. My name is Patrick Hester. I am an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. And this week I've got a panel of guys who are cracking me up and already making me laugh. So I just want to move ahead. Joining me tonight, first off, is Mr. John Anilio.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy and other nerdy things. You can get my album for as little as free over at johnanilio.bandcamp.com. You can follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/johnanilio. And I'm doing a video blog for Wired's Geek Dad blog called Geek Dad Guitar Lessons. So check that out, too.
Very awesome. Number two is Mr. Jeff Patterson.
This is Jeff. I write, I draw, I'm a sometime contributor to SF Signal, and my blog Gravity Lens can be found at baddaystudio.com.
Very cool. Number three, Mr. John DiNardo.
How you doing? This is John D. here from sfsignal.com. You can also find us on Twitter under the handle SF Signal.
Let's see, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, Matthew Smith.
Yes, Matthew Sanborn Smith. I'm a writer and podcaster. You can catch my latest story in Good Magazine number 6, and you can listen to my podcast, BewareTheHairyMango.com. Actually, it's Beware the Hairy Mango at BewareTheHairyMango.com. Or just go to SF Signal.
And last but certainly not least, Mr. Andrew Liptak.
Hello, I'm Andrew Liptak. I write for SF Signal and my own site, AndrewLiptak.wordpress.com, and I'm also on Twitter at Andrew Liptak.
Very cool. And guys, I forgot to send out the email about the bagels, so we didn't actually bring bagels tonight. Sorry, John.
Bad face.
Tonight we have a great topic that was suggested by Jeff. And
present.
Yes, you are. And you came up with a good idea, so I wanted to put it out there and let's talk about it. This is specifically about the Hugo Best Novel category. And space played no role in this year's Hugo nominees. And it was a year with Shara's Regenesis, Reynolds' House of Suns, and Hamilton's Temporal Void, three pretty good examples of space novels. Last year we had Saturn's Children and Zoe's Tale, which is sitting over on my nightstand waiting to be read, as nominees. It's only been 5 years since, I hate you. Algebraist?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And Iron Sunrise were nominated. So here's the discussion. Does this mean anything? Do Hugo votes actually gauge the state of the genre, or do they just indicate which books were marketed best? Have Daily Exoplanet Discoveries jaded fandom? Is it the space program's questionable future that colors this little decision-making process? Or is it just simply changes in the readers themselves? Let's go to Jeff, since it was your idea.
Okay. The discussion, all of those things above that you just mentioned, they get discussed year in, year out when this stuff happens. The year that Harry Potter won Best Novel was a good example. One of the things that came to mind after I made the suggestion was I went back and I reread The Island by Peter Watt, which won novella, I think. And I had totally forgotten that story is just brimming with sense of wonder, not to mention space, astral navigation, and all that stuff. So, though not really invalidating everything that I said, I did find it interesting when I started thinking about it. The whole concept of sense of wonder always being considered the tentpole of the genre. The books that were nominated for Best Novel, all of which are good books, all of which have some very interesting and exciting concepts at their centers, didn't really seem to be striving by design for sense of wonder. I mean, there's some oh wow moments, definitely, but they all seem to be striving for showing the world that they're in. They were more aiming towards world building without really trying to blow your mind with really trippy ideas. And the other thing that came to mind while considering it was, looking at the history of books, you got to look at, if I start taking a long view, if I start doing a deep time, long now type thing here, and you look at in the aggregate, the books that have been nominated that are basically either space opera or hard SF involving space. It kind of evens out, you know, over the long run. You know, Flowers for Algernon is just as much, you know, science fiction as Cold Equations, so you can't really, you know, rule it out because of the fact that it doesn't take place in space.
Sure.
And at the same time, I feel that this may just be, you know, it could be a blip on the radar, but I certainly don't want to dismiss it because I think it showed a definite trend in the readership towards the kind of stuff that was nominated. And I can't, you can't dump it all in because Wake by Robert Sawyer doesn't really fall in with the motifs that the rest of the books that were nominated really, really tried to grasp.
Okay. So, well, let's get another perspective. Matthew, what do you think?
You know what? Can I take a pass for just a second? Because my dog is out of control. I got to deal with the dog.
Yes, you can. Andrew. Right,
what I would say is that science, and this is something I will maintain for everything, and I've been writing a lot about it, and I've been thinking a lot about it, is that science fiction, like any sort of fiction, is representative of what is going on in the world right now. There was a interview on Wired magazine just yesterday, I believe, with author William Gibson, who wrote Neuromancer, and he had a great quote somewhere. I don't remember exactly what it said, but it was along the lines of that we don't write about the future, we write about right now. And I think that a lot of the books that were nominated, and I'm only really familiar with a couple, but like The Wind Up Girl is a book that is very, very, very relevant right now. There is a lot of talk about global warming. There is a lot of talk about agricultural companies and sure. major corporations sort of running rampant, things like that. And those are things that have been in the news lately. We have the disaster, well, at least recently, we have the fires in Russia. We have the flooding in Pakistan. We have companies like Enron and BP running causing lots of problems for everybody. There was a picture that Paolo posted up right around the same time that the oil spill was ongoing and basically said, it's one of my stories come to life. And it was a picture of a wave with oil in it. And, you know, I sort of saw that and I thought, well, that's a very science fiction-y thing that's coming true. And for whatever reason, we're starting to see more stories about this sort of nearer future coming true.
Okay. John, Anilio, what do you think? Do you think this means something? Is this the state of the genre now?
Not really. I mean, I think Andrew makes a good point of, you know, these books, a lot of them are very, representative of where our world is now. And I think, you know, it is science fiction. It's not space fiction. So, I mean, we think of science fiction as being space fiction quite a bit, but it is about different scientific concepts. And the other thing that I was thinking about is that, you know, it's science, you know, our genre really, it's always lumped in as science fiction and fantasy. And really, when you think about it, they're pretty different. I know from my own reading habits, I tend to skew towards fantasy. And I was looking over my Goodreads list of like the last bunch of books that I've read, and they're all, you know, pretty straight up fantasy. And even the stuff that I read that's considered science fiction is essentially fantasy in space, you know. So I think it's just
Barbarella?
I was thinking even, you know, like Star Wars, you know, something like Star Wars is not really science fiction. It's fantasy in space. You know, it's the space is the dressing for, you know, sort of your hero's journey story. And I know for me with something like The Wind Up Girl, which I haven't read yet, but I do read books like that. It's almost like that's the bran in my diet. Like, I know it's good for me to read those kinds of books. So I read them because I like to test myself. Often I think I'm not smart enough to read books like that, so I don't read anything with that. But I think in terms of the Hugos, I think it's just, you know, when you look at the books on the list, those were all books that I was very aware of before they were nominated for Hugos. They were books that, you know, as soon as they were released or prior to their release, they were marketed well. But it's also because they're probably just all good books by good authors. And, you know, I think they all belong there. And it just so happens that at the five that were chosen, none of them this time around happened to be space. I just think it's, you know, which is something that those five got chosen, and you can point to other space ones, and maybe next year it's five space ones. Who knows? I mean, people like reading a great cross-section of different things, and for this year, those are the ones that got nominated.
And that's possible, but I like the point about is it because the space program has a questionable future? Because if you go back far enough, you know, even back to the 70s, I mean, you had a lot of science fiction that was space-based and looking forward and going out into space. And now, you know, with everything going on with NASA, you kind of wonder if that isn't affecting people. What do you think, John DiNardo?
Yeah, I don't think that it's – I don't think that the lack of space stories on the ballot is necessarily indicative of anything. Space stories aren't going away. And I don't think any recent scientific discoveries are necessarily affecting it. I mean, we're learning about new planets and things all the time, but that doesn't mean they're not filled with sense of wonder reading stories about them or setting them on seeing some alien culture on some faraway planet. That's still interesting to me. That still stokes my science fictional fan fire, right? So I don't think you also got to consider trends, right? I mean, you know, things are kind of cyclical with, you know, space stories might not be hot on the ballot this year, but they might be next year or the year after that. It's, you know, it's not, they're not going anywhere.
I think next year is scheduled for vampire zombies in love musicals.
Something I would like to say that sort of jumps on what John was saying is that the space program has already hit its high point. They hit the moon in 1969. All we've done recently, you know, in the time since then, we've gone to a lower Earth orbit. We've found a lot of things that technology has improved, but we've never quite achieved that same pinnacle that captured the world's imagination, like the Apollo 11 landing. That's where everybody looked up into the sky and saw that one moment. And nothing we've really done since then captures quite the same way. So I wouldn't say that the space program is any sort of indication here. And honestly, the space program is going to continue. It might continue in different hands. NASA might have a different role, but there's certainly a lot of people who are interested in space. That just go look at SpaceX's long details of what they're doing on their missions, and you can see that there's a lot of people who are interested in what's going on next.
Okay,
and I think the lack of space stories on the ballot doesn't mean that you can't find them either, right? I mean, you mentioned a bunch of titles there. S. Andrew Swan has his Apotheosis series going on, which is just an excellent space opera that's just filled with sense of wonder. And if you know, I mean, you pick up any of these books, and it's like, you know, you can find the space stories that, you know, just to satisfy your space sci-fi Jones.
Matt Smith, are you back?
I am, and apologize.
No, you're fine now. I just need to know.
He was getting suggestions from his dog.
I was going to say, yeah. Does your dog have any thoughts on this? You know,
what I wanted to apologize for was if the listeners can hear her licking herself while I'm trying to speak. I'm sorry.
Well, we couldn't before, but now we can visualize it. Thank you.
Well, what's your take on this?
Well. I'm not sure that there's anything to this whole thing, but if there is, I would put forth the notion that maybe it has something to do with the economy, because books and stories lag behind, maybe a year or more behind what's actually happening in the real world between the time they are purchased and the time they're published. And I think maybe in bad economies, people... you know, you always hear the thing, why are we spending money in space when there's all these problems down here?
Sure.
You know, they never bring up the fact that we had all these problems before we went to space or, you know. But anyway, I think maybe in the good times, in the boom times, we're more likely to see some exciting spend all your defense money on the moonshot or whatnot coming out of stories.
Okay.
Can I respond to a couple things? Number one, I'm as we're talking, I'm looking at a list of nominees for best novels on Wikipedia, and I'm running with the concept of the science fiction being a reflection of what's actually going around. And if I had, you know, going on at the time, And if I had no knowledge of history, I'd be going back and saying to myself, my God, the 90s were an interesting decade. number one. Number two, I'm actually kind of fascinated with I've been to panels at conventions where they talk about, you know, the consensus future that existed in the 50s and to an extent into the 60s, and the whole the premise of a post-NASA consensus future where space exploration plays a much smaller role is kind of a fascinating thing, and I'm wondering if we're actually seeing the seeds of that coming up. But I also want to agree. I mean, I sent you guys a list before we talked to just the sheer number of space books that actually managed to come out in the past few years has been quite spectacular. And I've been enjoying most of them. So,
well, and the other interesting question that's part of all this is, you know, does the Hugo actually gauge the state of the genre, or is it just an indication of which books were marketed best, which were the best sellers? Anybody want to try to chime in on that?
I know. Talking with, I met Paolo Bacigalupi at ReaderCon, and he was saying, when I asked him, you know, so how does it feel to have your book be nominated? And he said, well, it goes completely against everything that I had known. He had put the book out there, and it hadn't been published. It went to a number of publishers, but once it started, it just started selling, and I think that it was more about the story rather than the actual marketing of it. I mean, it was a very handsome book to begin with, that had a very good cover. But I think that once people started reading it, word of mouth started, it got very favorable reviews, and that helped more than any sort of marketing program went.
Okay. I can see that.
It's true for The City and the City.
Yeah, I haven't read that yet.
Yeah. Well, I know what the wind-up girl, I know... I think I'd heard about it, you know, just through the regular blogs that I read. But I also know that Cory Doctorow was on a couple of the big podcasts, like maybe like This Week in Tech or a couple of the different ones. And they were sort of asking his recommendations. And he, you know, was very effusive in his praise for The Wind-Up Girl. And I know they even made that like the book of the month for the Sword and Laser podcast, which is the one that Tom Merritt and Veronica Belmont do. And I'm sure they have quite a large listenership and readership. So I know a lot of the right people kind of got behind that book that had big audiences. So, you know, I think a lot of times it's something like that, but it's like, it has to be a really good book because, you know, Paolo didn't pay Cory to pimp his book. Cory really liked, what's that?
Don't forget being listed on Time's top 10 of everything, 2009, yep. Right?
Yeah. Yep. Well, but it's you know, a steady process, because I remember Doctorow talking about it quite a while ago, and it's like, well, I mean, who knows how that all works? But then all of a sudden, another big group of people have it, and if it's a good enough book, then that next group of people that read it then recommend it on, and then it gets to more and more influential people, and then next thing you know, now it's winning awards. Then the award in general will then push it out there to more people than would have been aware of it. So I agree, because Andrew, I remember, I think you and I were talking about this at ReaderCon, that when you were talking about The Wonder Girl, that it wasn't necessarily, it didn't have a big, you know, marketing budget behind it or anything like that. I think
it's from a small press.
Yeah, it was a Nightshade that.
I think it is. Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. It was that it was good, and a lot of the right people loved it and recommended it, and there you go.
Yeah, John Scalzi also featured it as one of his big ideas, which gets a lot of hits.
Sure.
But the other thing, I think that the reason I picked it up is because it has one hell of a cover. Yes. And I think that this goes to saying, or goes to where, you know, people do judge books by their covers, and this is where having really good cover art really matters. Because I know I picked it up on the cover alone. I said, that looks awesome. I don't care if I read it. I want that in my house.
Okay, so...
loved it anyway.
I think it was SF Signal's mention of it that put it over the top, actually.
That's what I was thinking, too. I just didn't want to say, you know.
and that brings me...
Emilio.
that brings me around to, you've been gone for 2 weeks. You missed all the bagels. John DiNardo, why don't you wrap this up and bring this home for us?
Are you looking for a song? I'm confused.
Well, I mean, as far as the marketing is concerned, I mean, you know, what do you think?
You're asking if marketing helps it get on awards ballots.
Yeah.
I have no idea what makes books get on awards ballots. I mean, there are heavily marketed books that don't make it on the awards ballots. And, you know, Wind Up Girl was from a small press and did make it and tied for first place. So, you know, I don't think marketing has much to do with it. It certainly helps to get the, like we were saying, it helps to get the name out there and the recognition out there and into the hands, I guess, of the people who nominate it. So it can't hurt. I don't think it's based solely on marketing though. No.
I saw something on Twitter this week, and I wish that I had kept the link or I'd Evernoted it or something, but it was essentially someone was linking to a story that said that Dan Brown's books are most likely to end up being sold back to used bookstores.
Mm. Yeah, but that's because he sells a lot more than most people.
Well, the only thing I was thinking was, you know, I mean, here's something that is, you know, heavily, heavily marketed, tons of word of mouth, you know, people talking about it, and I don't know that people necessarily keep them.
Bookstore owners tell me that science fiction fans are the ones who sell back books the least.
Right.
Because they treasure their books, they keep their books. To sell
I am going to 3 big book fairs this weekend. I will come back next week with empirical knowledge on this subject.
Okay. Well, I think we got to call this one done for tonight. I don't know necessarily that we've come to a definitive decision, but we've definitely kind of sparked the embers here and kind of hopefully got the conversation going a little bit. For our listeners, stick around. We've got an interview with futurist Brenda Cooper coming up. And again, you're listening to the SF Signal podcast powered by the Functional Nerds. Thanks everybody for coming on tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Welcome to the interview portion of tonight's podcast. We are joined, Tim Zinsky, John Gnardo, and myself we're joined by Brenda Cooper, who is a futurist, a novelist, all kinds of things. CIO, I think I read in your biography.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? And that way, I'm not trying to do it.
Okay. I live in the Pacific Northwest. I love reading, meeting people, love the internet, love dogs, have been fascinated with science fiction since I was, as long as I can remember, probably since I was 5. In my teenage years, I carried around Heinlein books like my very best friends, and everybody called me a geek. And I'm still somewhat of a geek, which is why I do the technology job. And I'm not quite sure what else to add, so I think that's probably enough to start.
Okay. Like I said, I'm joined tonight by Tim Zinsky and John DiNardo. Let's see. What can we talk about? I mean, you've got 3 novels. Building Harlequin's Moon, The Silver mm-hmm. Ship and the Sea. Actually 4, right?
Right.
So reading The Wind and Wings of Creation.
Yes.
Tons of short fiction published all over the place. Do you prefer short fiction? Do you prefer the longer fiction? I mean, what's your preference when you sit down to write something?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. I probably like short fiction the best because it's a little more idea-driven. You can just kind of take a really good idea or read about something really interesting and finish getting something out there in a pretty short period of time. Like the last story I got up on Clark's World, I thought about it, I wrote it, I sent it, and then I could look at it, actually posted and available for people to read all within like maybe a month.
Wow.
And a novel is like a 3-year process. So I, you know, but I like them both. I'm just now finishing a novel. I mean, literally at the stage of reading for typos before I send it off to my agent. And I'm really looking forward to doing some short fiction for a while. So
very cool. John, you look like you had a question.
Maybe a two-part question is, I wanted to learn more about your background as a futurist and some of the training or education you got behind that, and what you actually do in that role, and then how that feeds into your fiction.
Yeah, I was going to say, add to that, tell people what is a futurist.
Okay. A broad definition to me of a futurist is somebody who really is interested in what the future is going to look like and is interested in tying that back to what actions we make today. In other words, someone who also wants to influence the future to some extent. There are a whole wide range of futurists. There are professional futurists who make their living doing that, maybe in a specific area, like there are energy futurists who work specifically on what is the future of energy going to look like, talk specifically about that, maybe work for a specific energy company about that. And then there are people like me who are a lot more generalists. I'm kind of interested in everything. I'm interested in robotics. I'm interested in 3D printing. I'm interested in where we're going socially and politically. I'm interested in things we're doing with genetics. So I like to just sort of tie all those things together and say, all right, if we're doing this thing and that thing, say 3D printing becomes popular and we begin to get to where we have 3D printers in our houses, how is that going to affect manufacturing? And then how is that going to affect globalization? And how is that going to affect copyright? So I just love just sort of playing with the way different things interact one with another. I got my start doing this actually when a futurist came down to talk to us at another city that I worked at. I worked in the city of Longview, which is kind of a small city in southern Washington, and we hired a futurist to help us develop a plan for the next 20 years. In other words, develop a futurist plan. And he was really interesting. His name is Glenn Heemstra. He runs worldwideweb.futurist.com, and he was the most interesting thing in this small town, which wasn't actually very hard. And so I would pick his brain at lunch, and then it was right at the beginning of the internet, and I became his first webmaster. I started writing content for his website. I had been interested in this kind of thing for a long time. I just never sort of put it out there. It had been kind of a personal, private thing. And then it sort of became, well, okay, I could write about this. And so I give talks, typically to business audiences, usually general business audiences who are just people that maybe are meeting, like I've talked to restaurant associations, I've talked to chambers of commerce, I've talked to schools, people who are just saying, what do we need to think about for the future and how do we need to prepare ourselves for it? So I'll go talk to people about things like that. It's kind of a part-time job. This year it's been more of a part-time job because my day job has been kind of really, really busy and my writing life has been really, really busy. So it sort of varies how much I'm actually doing with that as far as going out and speaking. I do a column at Futurismic. So I have a monthly column over there called Today's Tomorrows, which is just a blast to write about. And then I often use the ideas from research that I do for a futurist talk or a futurist column in stories or vice versa. Cool. Maybe I'll get an idea, put it in a story, and then put it in a column.
That's awesome.
That's neat. So are you looking at trends that you might see in the trade papers or the online versions, I guess? How do you learn about some of this stuff? Do you actively go out and look, or are you just trolling a whole lot of websites, or what are you doing?
I may actively go out and look if I get an interest in something. I've been really interested in the ocean lately, partly because of the BP oil spill, I think, partly because a couple of years ago I heard some oceanographers talk about how much we're not noticing, how much damage we're doing to the ocean. So I tend to have a lot of watches out on the internet for things like that so that I can pick up information on that topic. So if I have a topic that I'm interested in, I'll, put Google alerts on it and I'll, go look and things. But mostly I just read widely. I read everything from National Geographic to the little easy bits in Nature. I don't understand the hard parts, but I understand the easy descriptive parts. You can find things in the, your regular New York Times that talks about the future. And a lot of my friends are geeks. They're people, I think, like you all are. hopefully that's not a bad thing, but, you know.
Hey, I'm actually a functional nerd. I don't know about the other guys.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever. But, you know, a lot of my friends are people who are interested in science fiction and interested in technology and interested, I think, by definition, from there in the future. And I think all science fiction writers are, to some extent, futurists.
So the problem I have with the whole futurist thing is that it sounds like there's math involved, and I'm just terrible at math.
You know, there isn't math involved in what I do. There is math involved in scenario planning for specific industries. I've had some training in that, but I don't use it very often. So
when you talk about, you know, your Google alerts and kind of aggregating the different kinds of alerts and information that you're looking for, obviously we've come a long way in technology. And one of the things today that's, you know, it's really helpful for someone like you or someone like us who's looking for this stuff, but is also kind of a controversy for the content providers, is obviously things like, you know, Google and Google News and Google Reader. What sorts of technologies are you using? Are you using like an iPad? Do you have anything down that road? I mean, what are you doing to make it easier for you to find that information?
Oh, I'm a total early adopter. I have an iPad, an iPhone, a Kindle. But, you know, part of that's because of my technology job. The CIO job is a chief information officer job for a city where I'm responsible for all the phones and computers and computer applications and all of that. And I love the kinds of things that we can do with technology. I get interested in ways we make people's lives easier using technology. I was really out early on the internet. But you don't have to. I mean, I have futurist friends. I know a number of futurists from our area. We get together every few months and have lunch and chat. And a number of them really are paper people. And they, you know, there are books about the future, and you can go out and get a paper physical book and do that as well. So there's so many ways to get information.
Gotcha. Hey, Tim, I know you're dying to ask a question.
Yeah, well, it's not actually a futurist question.
That's okay.
I've read Building Harlequin's Moon. Right, which I thought was a great book.
Oh, and thanks.
I was really interested in, you know, what it was like to collaborate with Larry Niven. Right, I've also seen that you've written other stories with him. But, I mean, what is the collaboration effort like with, you know, I don't want to use the word legend, but I guess that's kind of what he is somewhat in the science fiction space.
I was so lucky. I don't know how to, you know, Larry has helped a number of people essentially get started. He does collaborate with a lot of people. He's probably collaborated with 10, 20 different people. He collaborates with Jerry Pournelle, Steve Barnes. Steve's first few books came out with Larry. Michael Flynn, tons of people. And it just came about by accident, like all things kind of come about by accident, just because you know people. I knew Steve Barnes, whom I had met because he was my martial arts teacher, and years ago when I had time to do things like martial arts. And he was just beginning to write with Larry at that time. So we developed a friendship that still exists today. Steve and I are still good friends. And at one point, when Larry was up there, I got a chance to meet Larry because he was working with Steve. And I was just a baby writer at that time. And I had, like, self-published a couple of things. And I got this fan mail piece from someone about something I had self-published on the internet. And it was the first piece of fan mail I'd ever gotten in my life. So I was super excited about that. ooh, look.
Isn't it so cool? It's like, oh, wow, someone likes what I wrote.
Yeah. So I showed the piece of fan mail to Larry, and we were both at the same science fiction convention. And so he looked at the story that it wasn't that story, but he looked at the story I was working on at the time, and it was a hard science fiction story, and he could immediately see about a billion things wrong with it. So that's how we did our first collaboration. And it since that worked, we did some more. Most of it's been long distance. You know, we both have lives in different states, and we haven't done that much collaboration lately. In fact, we haven't really collaborated anything for maybe 4 or 5 years. But it was scary at first, as part of your question. It was like, oh, my God, how can I, like, you know, want to change any bit of this guy's prose? You know, you're right. Crazy. But after a while, you learn, and you just sort of work it out. And it was really very much an apprenticeship, you know, because definitely he was just a master plotter, writer, thinker. He's just completely brilliant. And so I got a chance to learn an awful lot. And I would periodically get back pieces of email from him, like, you know, you really can't do that. You're nuts. You cannot have your character do X or Y. You know, so it was a great learning opportunity. I had to have a little bit of a thick skin to do it. Some of that actually got captured in a book called Scatterbrain that Larry put out, and it's got a portion of our email correspondence about one of the stories we did. So that's, you can actually find it.
Yeah, so that was going to be my follow-up to this was, you know, well, so it's 2005 the book was published, right? What was the collaboration, right? Were you emailing text back and forth, or were you actually mailing physical copies of data back and forth?
There was email in 2005. There was even email in 2000 when we started doing this, I promise.
I was there.
Tim, I was using email on a Linux machine or a Unix machine in like 96, 97.
Yeah, I've been doing this for a long time. I've been in the computer industry for, you know, since 1991, but it's still the question, right? It's
No, from mostly a technology we did standpoint, it.
It's only mostly recent that – sorry, go ahead.
You're okay. Just trying to answer your question. Mostly we collaborated by email. Sometimes we would be at the same convention and maybe we would meet for meals and talk about it. The storyline was born when we were both in the same physical place. Larry has this habit of talking to people and saying, well, tell me a story. And then you're like totally on the spot and have to come up with a story. So I started telling him a story and he started elaborating on it. And that's how we started. And I don't think at first we were sure we were going to turn it into a book. And then it just kind of happened that we both kept working on it. And then it became a book.
Very cool.
So we were writing it in like 2000 and 2001, I think.
You talk about, I would struggle to do the collaboration thing. I mean, that there's got to be a lot of give and take in that.
There is. It would be harder for me now. I mean, I could collaborate with Larry because we have figured out how to do that.
How dare you change my text? I wrote a book with Larry Niven.
No. No, I am not a major writer, and I have a lot to learn still, okay? but I think you have to be wanting something from the collaboration, and I wanted to learn how to write and to get published, and what Larry said he wanted was to learn how to write female characters better. So we both had something that we wanted to get out of the collaboration, because a collaboration is more work than writing something by yourself. But I know a number of people that collaborate and do a really good job on it, because it's a way of being social while you're writing, which is generally a very not social activity.
Right.
So it's kind of nice. I would collaborate again in the right circumstance with the right people. I'm probably way too busy right now to do very much of that. But I think I got an awful lot out of it and came out ahead. So.
Did you ever participate in any sort of writing groups or critique groups or anything like that?
Tons. And some of them were fabulous and some not so much. So there's a wide variety of writing groups. And my very first writing group, in fact, was back in the small town where I met the Futurist in Longview. And there were four of us. There was me writing science fiction. There was another woman writing children's fantasy. There was a woman writing memoir. And there was a woman writing Christian young adult fiction. Because there weren't four science fiction writers in town that we could all find each other. Hmm. And we would meet and have tea at one of these women's houses once a month. And it was just fabulous. And that was probably one of the best writing groups I've ever been in, because we were really at the early stage where all of us knew absolutely nothing. And we'd be going through, well, now how do you represent thoughts in someone's head? And you know, so we were down at a really basic level, and everybody learned a lot from each other. And then I'm still in a writing group today.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. And with all published people that are up here in the Northwest. And it's also fabulous.
Gotcha. Now, because my brain kind of works differently and I jump from subject to subject, back on the futurist thing for just a second, as a futurist, can you definitively tell us, yes or no, will Skynet rise and take over the planet?
I cannot definitively tell you anything as a futurist because, you know, we can look at all the trends and stuff. But if you ask us for, like, stock picks, we'll probably fail. The world is too chaotic for that.
So the real question is there a trend that Skynet will become a real thing? Huh? See, it's all on how you ask the question.
Yeah, it's not something I've studied a whole lot. I'm sorry. Oh. I wouldn't know how to answer that. But, you know, you sound like you've got some expertise, so you could decide.
He's still trying to figure out email. I deserve that.
Well played, hey, John.
I have a question. So they say to be a good writer, you need to be well-read. And I don't know if they actually specify well-read in science fiction if you want to be a science fiction writer, but it stands to reason. So my question is, which of today's writers do you read, and which writers do you think aren't as popular as they deserve to be?
Okay, well, that's two questions.
Yeah, well, I'm allowed to ask two.
You're allowed to ask as many as you like.
Yeah, I can keep going.
I read a lot of the people who I think are just brilliant up-and-coming writers that I want to learn from. Like, I read a lot of what Paolo puts out, Paolo Bajicalupi. I read Christine Catherine Rush, who I think is doing some of the best short fiction in science fiction right now. I read Nancy Kress. I love Ken Scholl's new fantasy series that he's working on. I kind of read everything. I mean, if you ask me for a list of writers, I might list 30 or 40 or 50 people. And I don't read just science fiction. You know, that's important, but I think it's important to read widely. So I'm actually in a group of people, other writers, where we purposely read out of genre bestsellers to try to figure out why they're bestsellers and see what we can learn from that. So that ends up getting me reading books that I wouldn't otherwise read. This time, for example, we're reading that trilogy that's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and all of that. Ooh. I started that. I read the first one and had to read the other two because it was so good. I ended up going through all three of them really quickly.
It's a good endorsement for Stieg Larsson, right?
Oh, he's great. Those are great books.
Do you find that reading those books, like, analytically, it sounds like? You enjoy them on that level, but does that enjoy it from a fiction reading, like a fan perspective, or?
Well, I try to approach everything I read first as a reader and read it through once and see what kind of a reader experience I get.
Right.
And in fact, if I get bored, I will not finish something anymore because I'm too busy. So I do read as a reader to start with for pleasure. And then if I really like the book and want to analyze it, I'll go back and reread it. And if it's a really good book, I might even have to reread it two or three or four times before I can start to see what the author did in order to make the book be that good. But I think I've learned a lot about pacing and hooks and characters from reading these other works. For example, Stieg Larsson's series is just fabulous because he's so good at character.
Hmm.
You know, his characters just come completely off the page.
And there's also so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's tons of plots and twists and threads kind of running through those.
Mm-hmm. There is. No, he does everything really, really, really well. But, you know, but Lisbeth Salander, who is his main character, is what makes that series better, I think, than any of the other sort of thriller detective combination genre things that I've read for years, because she's just such a fascinating character and she's different. She's different than anybody else I've ever met on a page.
Mm-hmm. What about John, the second half of John's question? You know, who do you think, how would you say it, John, is out there really popular but doesn't necessarily deserve it?
Yeah, who should be more popular than writers that people don't know about but should?
Opposite.
Yeah, the opposite. Who should we? Well, I think Toby Bekele doesn't get as much credit as he should get. He does get some. I mean, a lot of people do read Toby, but I think he's fabulous, and I would kind of surprised he doesn't get a little bit more. I'm sort of standing here and looking at my list of to-read books, trying to figure out, you know, where am I gonna find that. Someone up and coming who does really good short fiction is Camille Alexa. She's a writer from our area in Portland, and she's just fabulous. I don't know that she has any novels out yet, but she does have a series or a collection out called Push of the Sky. But I think you'll hear more about her, even if you haven't yet. Mary Rosenblum, I think, doesn't get nearly as much attention as she should. I think her short fiction is fabulous. I think her novels are really good, too, but her novels have never seemed to really sell in as large an amounts as I think they ought to. So that's a few.
Okay. Well, what does the future hold for Brenda Cooper? What are you working on? What do you have planned to come out soon?
Well, as I said, I'm really looking forward to going back and doing some more short fiction. I do have a piece coming out soon in Analog that is set in the same world as my three novels, and it's actually set before the events from The Silver Ship in the Sea. It's sort of at the very beginning of the colony. These are sort of colony novels, or space colonization novels. Mm-hmm. And that was really fun, and I'm looking forward to that coming out. I have a book coming out next year that Sean Wallace is putting out from Prime Books, and the book is called Mayan December. Mm-hmm. And it's a December 2012 book.
Okay.
It's very different from anything I've ever written. It is science fictional, and it's kind of also a historic romance. So it's stuff I really haven't ever written before. But I just got so interested in the story and so interested in the research I did on sort of Mayan end times, and interested in the math of the Mayans. There's that word again, math, but the math and the science and the astrology and all these things that these people knew. So this was just a really fun book to read, and it is not like the 2012 movie.
it's not a disaster. Good.
Yeah, I think it's a lot better than that movie. So I'm really looking forward to that coming out. The book I just finished is kind of an Evita in space. I've been interested in Eva Perón and all the ways that this one person had so much influence over the society of her time, especially given that women had very little influence in that time. So I have a Generation Starship book coming out with a strong female character who has a lot of influence about her time. Now, obviously, I didn't put Argentina in the spaceship, and I don't have her leaning over a balcony singing about Argentina. But
oh, man. is there a musical number? That's the key.
He said, is there a musical number?
There are actually songs in the book, which I have never done before. I have written and published poetry. I did put some songs in the book, not with scores, so maybe they'll be filked, and somebody who can actually write music will do something. You know, one of the things I've always wanted to write.
If only we knew somebody.
I was going to say, as a matter of fact, we might know somebody whose name shall remain John Anilio.
All right. Well, we'll see. Maybe I'll get lucky. So I'm really pleased with that novel, and I don't yet have a publication date or, in fact, a publisher for it. So more info to come on that. Watch my website.
Any chance that you'd be willing to write a book called Back to the Futurist?
Oh, my God.
Oh.
No, but I might have to write a blog post titled that now. That's actually pretty sweet.
any plans to attend any conventions coming up soon, or make any appearances, do any signings, any of that kind of stuff?
I will be at World Fantasy. Quite looking forward to that. That's sort of my favorite convention. I'll be at the local conventions here, the NorwestCon convention, which is in SeaTac in April, and at OriCon in November, actually OriCon this November, so that's coming up pretty quick. And probably that's about it. I've got a really busy year, so I'm doing fewer conventions than usual.
Well, John Anilio and I just decided to go to World Fantasy Con. We haven't actually announced it. I guess we just did.
I guess you did.
So
we're going to have to meet for a drink.
Yes, and he's bringing his guitar, so, you know, we can just make him sit there and write a song for you, you know.
Bring your lyrics,
yeah.
Oh, well, you know, send me an email address. I'll send you my lyrics.
Okay.
Actually, I don't think I have any complete songs. Well, actually, I do have one complete, and the other ones I have stanzas. But at any rate,
he did the song for Resnick in the Flagship stuff for Pyre. It's actually in the, which book is it, John? Is it like the fifth one?
Flagship, the last one.
Yeah, so it's in the back of that.
I love the stuff Lou Anders puts out. So we have to have a drink at World Fantasy. And have you been to World Fantasy before?
I have not. The biggest thing I've been to is BlizzCon.
Okay, 75% of World Fantasy happens in the bar, and the programming's actually good.
It's probably true for a lot of conventions.
I was going to say, that's just about every convention, yeah. We already owe Resnick a dinner. We told him we'd get him a dinner if we went. We probably, if Lou Anders shows up, we're going to have to buy him like 20 drinks or something. So
Lou is awesome.
He is. He's been great. He's been on both podcasts, the Functional Nerds and SF Signal, and just a great guy. We get along well with Lou.
He's really brilliant.
I understand also that in his youth he would take any dare. And one of his authors was just telling John and I this the other night, and he's like, yeah, I understand that someone dared him to eat like this massive burrito one time without using his hands, and he did it. And, you know, he'll accept any dare. And I said, well, dang, I'm going to finish my book and dare him to publish it.
Good luck.
Yeah, that's not going to happen anytime soon. Okay, well,
finishing the book? Just right.
Yeah.
There's no secret to finishing a book. Just right.
Exactly. Yep. No, I'm just mean, you know, daring him to do that. Anything else, guys? Tim, do you have any other last-minute questions?
No. It was great to hear a lot of the answers that were given. It was I don't really think about futurists very much, but it's I guess most people in tech tend to be that way. So it gives me some stuff to think about as I troll my blogs.
It sounds like a sweet gig. It sounds like a lot of fun, and then you get to talk. You get to look into all these different areas of technology. So it sounds like it never gets boring.
It is. It's a lot of fun, and periodically I even get paid for it.
Yes,
not always,
better.
But every once in a while.
So before we go, why don't you tell everybody where to find your stuff? Tell them about your website, your Twitter, all that good stuff.
Okay. Well, my website is worldwideweb.brenda-cooper.com. Hang on. Okay. Twitter, I'm just Brenda Cooper. The Twitter is just all my name, all put together. And if you go over to Futurismic, you can just, if you just search for Brenda Cooper, you search for Today's Tomorrows, you can find the column and take a look at that there. Mm-hmm. My books are available pretty much in all the online venues. They're a little harder to find in the bookstores right now because everything's harder to find in the bookstores that didn't just come out.
Yep.
So that's not new, but a number of them are available in a variety of online formats. You can get them in iBooks. You can get them on for Kindle, et cetera. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yep. Nice to meet you all. I'll see you at World Fantasy.
Wonderful. All right, sweet. I think that's it.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Toodles.
Signal.